Blog Talk Radio.
Good Saturday morning, my friends. Saturday, March 22nd. Can you believe it is spring? And they said we might get more snow in Philadelphia on Tuesday. Well, my son told me that. You got to be kidding. We have had so much snow this winter. I was going to wash my car later today, but I'm going to put that off. But I want to welcome all of you to Off the Shelf again for this Saturday, March 22nd. We're into spring and could get more snow. But I thank you so much for joining us here this morning. As I always tell you, I appreciate you so much. It's such a joy to have you here with us, especially our listeners who have been with us for going on 11 years. 11 years. 11 years. So I thank you for your loyal support. And to our listeners who just are just tuning in to Off the Shelf Radio for the first time, I want to introduce myself to you. I'm your host, Denise Turney. And I always say I'm coming to you live from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the city of brotherly love. And thank you again for your support. And please go out and get a copy of my new book, Love Pour Over Me. You're going to get mystery, romance, the friendships in this book. They extend across decades, the friendships that these guys develop in college. And then there is a very gripping relationship between a father and a son. And you'll see how it changes both men as the story unfolds. If you value relationships and friendships and you like romance and mystery, you will really enjoy Love Pour Over Me. And there's about six main characters in the book that you can really, really get close to. You can get Love Pour Over Me anywhere, online or offline. It's an ebook form. It's in print at Barnes & Noble, Walmart, iTunes, anywhere, Amazon, ebook it. You can get it. If you don't see it on the shelves in the stores, just ask the clerk for it, and they can order a special copy for you because it's carried by the largest book distributors in the world. And you can read free excerpts at my website, which is chistell.com. So please go out and support Love Pour Over Me. And, again, I do appreciate it. I appreciate you so, so much. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. We have had some phenomenal guests on, and I got to tell you, in the coming weeks, the very first part of April, we're going to have a guest on who sold over more than 120 million books worldwide. He's been television, you name it. So I really think you'll enjoy it. Continue to listen to Off the Shelf because we just keep coming up with these fabulous guests like our guest today. Now, our special guest today is Charles Macy. Charles grew up in upstate New York. He served in the United States Navy for 6 years. He also has an engineering and sales background, and companies he has led include Macy Engineering Associates, Infotech Consulting, and Cater Cats Catering. I like that name. Periodicals Charles has been published in include Reader's Digest, Twilight Zone Magazine, and Analog Publications. He is the author of the book Stains on the Gavel, A Boy in the Bin, which is a children's book, and penned A Kentucky True Crime. You can learn more about Charles and his books by visiting him online at www.starshowpublications.com, which is spelled the way it sounds, StarShowPublications.com. And again, that's StarShowPublications.com. So you can go over there and check him out, read his more information on his books, even as you listen to him interview on Off the Shelf this morning. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Charles.
Good morning. Good morning to you and all your listeners.
It's just such a pleasure to have you here with us to bring another. That's what makes our shows good, the things that our guests share, the entertaining things, how they develop their stories and to learn more about their books and with their experiences in the book publishing world. It's just that's what makes Off the Shelf a great, great show. So I want to thank you for being here. I want to start, I always like to give our listeners some backstory on our guests so they can get just a little background information on our guests before I launch into questions about their books. So I want to start by asking you, Charles, what was life like for you when you were a kid growing up in upstate New York?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that because I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I'm 65 now, and I haven't determined that yet. But apart from that jab at humor, I had a pretty good upbringing. I lived in a modern neighborhood and went to modern schools and everything like that, and I had two sisters and a brother, and we all used to tease each other, and it was a pretty wholesome environment.
Okay. Now, what did you said your joke about you haven't grown up yet, so you haven't decided what you want to become? But when you were a kid, what did you dream of becoming when you grew up? Did you ever think, I want to be whatever? When you were a kid, what did you dream of becoming?
Well, for a long time, I thought about being a Christian minister. I was really sort of immersed in my faith, and I thought that was a good job. But it was kind of one of those things that there was a materialistic side of me that I wanted to make money, and I knew that pastors and priests and people of the cloth didn't really make too much money. So,
well, some of them do.
Well, some of them do if you got a big church,
right?
But I wasn't really concerned about what I want to be when I grow up, because I've always had a youthful attitude, and I just didn't really know. There were a lot of opportunities. One of the biggest problems I had was what I wanted, which was to be a disc jockey. They said, "Oh no, you can't do that. That's not for you. You need to be an engineer, or you need to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. Like, you're not going to waste your talent being a disc jockey." So, and as life went by, one of the things that I did was I started a this is back in the 70s. I started a sound company, and I went around from bar to bar being a disc jockey.
Ah, okay. So you did get to do what you wanted to do. I got to ask you two more questions before we start talking about Panda, Kentucky True Crime. How disc jockey, and then your family was encouraging you to go into engineering, was more of a stable career, and engineering does pay well. What happened? When did this happen, and what happened to cause you to know, I'm going to be a novelist?
Oh, that's always been inside me. I mean, when I was growing up, and just, I'd write little stories and do little play skits. I remember playing with my siblings, and I had a movie camera, a little 8mm movie camera, and I used to make movies of, the same person coming out of a barrel and just weird stuff, And I would make up stories and have my siblings help me as supporting acts, supporting part of the act and all that, and film them, just entertain my parents and friends that were watching. And gradually, as I got older, I was submitting articles to magazines and all that. And I always liked to write. I had a pretty good command of the English language. And I just really never got to that point of being a novelist until later in my years, when I finally, took the charge of the reins and I wrote Pinned.
Wow. So for our off-the-shelf listeners who love to write as a child, and you're thinking, wow, it's passed me by, I'm just going to have to stick with this job that I have, you can be encouraged with Charles Macy's story. You can still go back and do it. Another question that when I was researching for your interview, something that popped out to me that I found very, very interesting. Now, I was born in Ohio and grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. moved in when I was 9, and then now I'm in Philadelphia after I got out of the Navy. I wanted to ask you, you're a long way from upstate New York these days. How in the world, just curious, how did you get from upstate New York to Kentucky?
Well, believe it or not, I always hated where I grew up. I grew up in Syracuse, New York.
Okay.
And I didn't like it at all. So, you know, I mean, I did my stint in the Navy. I got out, and I worked for a while in the engineering field. I have a degree in engineering, and I worked for a while in the engineering field, and a lot of what I did was contract engineering. So I went from place to place. You know, I lived in 13 different states, and they were all better than New York. But for whatever reason, I always kept getting yanked back to New York for family or, maybe a job ended or something like that, and I came back, and then something else would pick up, and I'd go to another state. And I've had pretty mobile life throughout the course of my life, in different things. Now, I came back in 1995 and pretty much decided I'm sick and tired of traveling and ended up having a couple different companies that I was involved in. I was involved in an engineering company, and then I shifted over to the IT business, and I was CEO of an IT company. Sold that out in 2003 and thought I was going to retire, and I spent about 6 months just drinking myself into a coma, and I decided that this wasn't my life. So I ended up starting a catering company with my girlfriend, and I did that for quite a while until about 2008, and I decided I'd had enough of New York, and met a girl on the internet. And she lived in Kentucky, and that's how I ended up down in Kentucky.
Oh, okay. You're adventurous, and also you're definitely an entrepreneur. No doubt about it. No doubt about that. Now, when and why did you write Penned, a Kentucky True Crime?
Well, I got wrapped up with this young lady in Kentucky, and fell head over heels, and it turned out that she was in actuality a black widow, and I didn't realize that. I was blinded by love, and
oh wow!
6 weeks after I moved in with her, and I had come back to Syracuse, got all my possessions, and moved down there. And 6 weeks later, I was arrested. What she claimed were factual, and thrown in jail. And in the meantime, she packed up the house and all her possessions and all my possessions and moved and left me down there in Kentucky with no resources, no friends, no money.
Wow.
And Penned, Kentucky True Crime, is actually a journal of what happened to me. It's a true story. I mean, everything in the book is true.
Oh, my goodness.
And I actually lived it. Now, the reason why the character list is different is I knew I was going to write this book when I was sitting in jail, and I said, I don't need to have anybody coming after me for plagiarism or anything like that, but I do want to get the story out, and my friends encouraged me, you need to write this book, you need to tell this story, and that's how it all came about. It actually,
wow,
the formation of Penned happened when I was sitting in jail.
Now, when was the book published?
Originally, the book was published in 2012, and I spent about 9 months with that publisher, spent a ton of money, and they did absolutely nothing for me. So I redesigned the content of the book and switched publishers, got a new cover and everything like that, and reintroduced the book with the new publisher in 2013. And by then, I had almost completed the Stains on the Gavel, which is part two of the story.
Wow.
So that's why the first pin came out in March of 2013, and Stains on the Gavel came out in June of 2013. That's why they're so close. I've written them both.
Now, okay, this is based on true real-life experiences that you have. Can you tell our listeners what do you go from, like, your childhood, or do you start – can you just tell us a little bit, without giving the story away, what do you cover in – because Stains on the Gavel takes up where Penn's stops. But can you tell us where do you – some of the parts of your life that you cover in Penn, A Kentucky True Crime? And do you give us background – on the woman in the story as well, in the book?
Oh, yeah. Actually, Penn starts out my arrest, and then it goes back into the backstory, which is how I got to that point. It tells the background information of what I was doing and what my life was like and my background and everything. Back before I even met this girl and all that, and it works its way up through the book up to the arrest, and then part two of that book details what happened to me after the arrest, and it ends right before I go into a jury trial for trying to defend myself.
Wow.
And that essentially completes Penn, and then Stains on the Gavel picks up at that point. Stains on the Gavel has an extensive introduction of what went on in the past. It's kind of a summarization, and then it picks up the day of the court and the conviction, and then, when I went to prison and all that, and how I ended up, what happened to me in the course of being incarcerated, and how I ended up, fighting my way to the top and getting my freedom.
Jeez. Now, you wrote Penn the entire time what you were in jail waiting for the trial to start. Is that accurate? You wrote the book the whole time you were in jail waiting for the trial to start?
No, not actually, because I didn't have access to anything, and in Kentucky, they don't subscribe to helping inmates that much. I had a lot of difficulty in even just getting legal texts to do the research on it. Basically, I wrote the outline of Penn when I was out on bond before I went into a jury trial, and it sat there, I had saved it and archived it and sent it to a friend of mine, and it sat there for the time that I was incarcerated until I got out, and then I reworked the story and brought it out. I went through the traditional publishing things of getting it, copy edited and proofread and all that stuff, and all that, after I had been finally released. So I was completely free of incarceration before the book actually came out. But the structure, the layout of it, was all done.
Now, you're Mark Casey in the story, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And so you go through, you're covering your life again, you're to stage up into meeting this woman who, I'm assuming, she's Roxy, correct?
That's correct.
Oh, okay, because I was going to ask you what draws, I thought it was a novel, so I was going to ask you what draws Mark to Roxy. You met her online, but what was it that attracted you to her? And then I have to ask you, has she already done this crime that you were pinned with before you even got to Kentucky?
Well, essentially, we met on a, she responded to a Craigslist ad that I had put in the personal column. Basically, it was something like, you know, I had a description of myself, and I had said that I was looking to have my soul kissed. And I didn't know, I had never been on Craigslist, on personals or anything like that. I didn't know what the response would be. And she responded to it and started, we opened up a dialogue, and she was down in, she wasn't in actually the area that I was looking at, because I was looking to relocate to maybe Knoxville or North Carolina or something like that. But she was in Kentucky, and I thought, well, wow, she's down, you know, part way down near where I want to go. And as our online relationship developed, it was magic. It was like every single facet that I found desirable in a woman, she had. She was very witty.
But this puts me in mind of the football player. I don't know if you heard about the story. And then there was somebody he was relating to. He was really involved into, and it turns out it wasn't even a woman. But they talked on the phone and everything. Had you, the two of you, ever met, or was it just emailing each other?
Initially, it was just email. Then it went to telephone conversations, and it got to the point where we were talking on the phone every day.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it came to a point where we decided, you know, we have to have a face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was I took a bus down to Kentucky, where she lived. She picked me up, and my thought was to go down there for a week, have a meeting, you know, with her and see how we get along and whatnot. And I was intending to, you know, stay at a local motel or something like that, and she wouldn't have anything to do with that. She is like, you're coming back to my house, and, you know, everything was just magic. And when I first, you know, laid eyes on her, she was just this absolutely model quality, beautiful, redheaded female.
And doesn't that get the guys?
And, you know, I saw her face, and that's the last I saw in my heart.
Wow. Wow. So you guys, how long were you communicating before you actually moved to Kentucky?
About 2 months.
Oh, wow, that was quick.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It moved even quicker when I got down there. We had her face-to-face. I mean, we stayed together down in Kentucky for about, maybe 2 weeks. She had family and friends up in upstate New York, and so...
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
you both
she
had
was
those...
from... She was from my area, and her
wow.
daughter was, allegedly, her daughter was going to be graduating from Syracuse University, which later turned out it wasn't. It was a local college near here, but it wasn't Syracuse University. But it was like everything that, you know, that I presented, she responded immediately with exactly what I wanted to hear.
Wow. That's almost scary when you think about it. When you think about how many people today are, and a lot of the relationships do work out, but there's your fair share that go very, very, very bad. But a lot of people are, they say they're busy, they don't have the time to get out and date like people used to meet people in person, so they're doing the online thing. But I know as a writer, I'll see ads for writers to write dating profiles for these sites, and I'm like, other people probably, I've never done it, but I'm thinking other people probably don't even know. This person might not even have written this ad. Somebody else could be doing this for
mm-hmm.
them, and you're just assuming that everything is legit. Is legit. They like
well,
you said, you got.
that's kind of the thing, because I, even though I've had a lot of experience in business situations and been all over the country working and met a broad cross-section of people, I still had that naivete that because I'm an honest and reputable individual, that most everybody else is too, and I can spot a phony a mile away, and, you know, I had a certain ego problem with that because I, you know, my native trust in humanity and other people, and that played a big part in why she was able to manipulate me to the degree that she did.
Wow. Can you, I don't know if you legally are able to, but can you give us some background, what you, I'm sure you probably, once this happened, first of all, once you got arrested, did you even have a clue what was going on, or were you so blindsided that you probably thought they got the wrong guy?
Actually, and I detail that in the book, is when they were questioning me the night of my arrest, they were trying to get me to say that, you know, the reason for the arrest, what it was is they found a large quantity of illegal drugs in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to get me to say that it was hers. And at that point, this is my lover. This is my girlfriend. I'm not going to implicate her. So I was mum about that situation. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't commit. I was like, look, I don't know if it's hers or not, but it's not mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand that in the background, you know, while she was talking to them, she was going, oh, yeah, he came down here and he bought you know, all these drugs with the intent to go back to New York and sell it.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And I didn't find that out until I got to jail, and they had given me my papers and all that, and I looked at her statement that was written down in there, and I almost fell over. You know,
oh, my God.
Up until that point, I'm thinking I'm trying to protect her, and this is wrong, and, you know, this can't be happening. And I look at what she wrote, and it was like, you know, yeah, he came down here, he bought up all these drugs.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
And there's a lot more to the story than...
It's
than
very interesting because,
you know,
now it seems like there's another party involved that she knew that you later found out about. I mean, it makes it like you have to read the book to find out what to fill in the missing pieces. And maybe she was just looking for somebody, as in yourself, to be the scapegoat for whatever she was planning. Wow. Wow. Which is... Pretty amazing. Did you go then from that, everything she had told you, I'm assuming, and I'm thinking about that football player again, when that happened to him, it was all over ESPN. When that happened to you, did you then go and say, I gotta find out everything about this woman and go back and dig up her past and start talking to people, if someone would talk to you, because you were a stranger in Kentucky. Did you do that, being that you both, she said she was from upstate New York? And if so, were you able to, and do you do this in the book, piece together some background on her as well?
That's what I did. I mean, first of all, time moves at an incredibly slow pace down there, because I'll give you an example. I got arrested on a Thursday, and I'm used to, you know, the court cases that I've been involved in, not, you know, myself, criminally or anything like that, but in New York, I mean, you know, people get arrested on Thursday and they're arraigned the next day. They go in front of the judge and they hear the case, and the judge makes a determination whether they're going to go to jail or whether they're going to get bond or you know, what the deal is. Not so in Kentucky. I sat in jail for a full week before the court case even came up in front of the judge. And basically they said, well, we don't believe your story, and you're incarcerated, and we'll get back to you, and threw me back in jail. And it went on and on and on like that for 4 months before I was ever given the opportunity to even bond out, to even get free. And so once I got free and I was out on bond, and I started doing background investigation, which in reality I should have done in the beginning, but I didn't.
Right.
That's when the floodgates opened up, and I found out so much about her that she had been in several mental institutions, that the person before me that had lived with her before me allegedly had blown his brains out, and it's disclosed in there, you know, in a conversation that I had had with her, that in reality she shot him and got away with it. And all these little bits and pieces, like parts of a tapestry, started coming together, and it painted a very black picture. And this wasn't the first time that she had done this. I mean, just to give you an example, she had had her husband, who was a Canadian national, arrested for domestic abuse, had him deported from the country because he was a foreign national. He wasn't a citizen in the United States. And then she promptly took all his construction equipment and everything and sold it.
So you learned, before we go on for our listeners, and then again I'm going back to that football player, and I'm told that this is more common than people might want to believe, but for people who you see the ads and Match.com, and I'm thinking of, I'm seeing more and more of them on, there's one for a Jewish dating site, Christian dating site, people just assume, like if you go to a Christian dating site, these are, like you did, all these people are who they say they are. I knew a guy who told me he met a woman online, and when he met her in person, the way she described herself was physically so far from the facts. He couldn't believe it. He said he just wanted to run. It's so people, you know, just because, like you said, you might be honest, you have to keep it. There are people who play games on these, and we see that in the news stories that some of these games turn fatal. But what advice would you have to a listener who maybe goes to the Christian dating site or something, and they just assume these are all good, upstanding people, would never tell a lie, they're who they say they are, they don't have anybody writing their profiles, they're not using somebody else's picture. What would you say to somebody who's about to either get married or just sell all their stuff and go move in with somebody that they met online?
Well, I guess looking back at it, I think that the entire internet dating scene is a valid concern, because there's an awful lot of lonely people out there that are just looking. They, you know, whatever their lifestyle is, maybe they, you know, they're not comfortable going into a cocktail lounge or meeting people in public, so they have to resort to meeting people via some sort of a dating site, or like I did Craigslist and all that. And so I think there is validity in that, but I would issue the caveat that do your due diligence. It's fine to have a dialogue that's harmless over the internet, but if it starts getting to where you're thinking about meeting one-on-one or going out on a date or something like that, spend the money and do a background investigation and dig up whatever dirt they're not telling you. Because let's face it, people are not going to point out their bad side. They're always trying to point out their good side. And yes, you do have people that are, you know, they're taking Jennifer Lopez's picture and putting it on themselves and playing and all that. But if you get down to the nitty gritty and you go to meet them, well, then you'd immediately know that they've been lying to you. But it's not so easy when they actually are putting their picture out on there, and they actually are telling truths and half-truths and hiding the dark side. So I would recommend you know, if you're going to go into this arena, it's fine to go into the arena and investigate it, and maybe potentially you will find your soulmate. But do your due diligence. Do a background check on everybody that you have any intention of going out and dating and meeting on a physical level. Because
now how do you do that? Employers can do a background check, and they can find out if you had anything comes up on your criminal background history. They can find out if you lied about schools you said you went to. They can find out, you know, certain, if you lied and you said you had all these degrees and you don't have them. They can find out if you lied and you said you worked for some big company and you never ever worked at that firm. They can get that, but like you said, with this woman with the mental illness or somebody setting somebody up for charging them with something that they didn't do and then having them deported, if that person wasn't convicted, they're probably not going to show up on a criminal background check. How, like, you probably had to really dig or hire a private detective to do that for you. How would somebody do that if it's in, you know what, I want to date somebody online, I want to get a background check on them. Would they have to go through a private detective? I don't think a normal background check would pull that up.
No, there's services out there you do a search on their name and it comes up, yeah, we have information on this, and for a fee, they will give you their home address, a phone number, professional certificates, history of spouses, and if they had divorces in the past, it's going to show up. Any criminal arrest charges are going to show up. You pay these services, and it's anywhere from, I think, probably about $20 to $50 or so. You pay, and you'll get a summarization. Now, obviously, it's not going to tell you whether, they lived in an abusive relationship and they got divorced or anything like that, but the glaring lies are going to stand out. I mean, if they didn't have a degree from a college, or if they weren't actually licensed to be a nurse or whatever, that's going to show up. But it's not going to tell their deepest, darkest secrets, but at least it gives you a foothold.
You can see that this person's not truthful.
Yeah, or they are. You know.
Right.
I mean, you know, the old saying, all that glitters is not necessarily gold, is very true in this. And I would just recommend to everybody that if they're going to go into this, it's fine to go into it, but take a jaundiced view of it. Look at it with a healthy degree of pragmatism until you are proven wrong, until you are proven, yay, it is gold.
Yeah, wow. I think I'd have to agree with that. And I think as we move forward with more of the online dating and so much stuff going mobile, and our society is changing, and I think that I could only imagine. And when I think about it, something like that would make a great novel, where you have these two people meet online, and one of them's got a very checkered past. The other one is a stand-up person, and they get this person involved in something that takes them years to get out of. Oh my goodness! I got to ask you. And I know the character for our off-the-shelf listeners, who is Charles, is Mark Casey, and then the woman is Roxy again. Would the situation for Mark or yourself be different if you were from the South? And I'm now starting to talk about stains on the gavel. Somebody who has long roots in the same town that they're going to trial in, would it have been different?
My opinion on that is yes. And no. The only reason why I hold back a little bit on it is in the situation that I was in, it was a small little town that everybody knew everybody else's business. And I'll give you a for instance.
Let me ask you before you go on. I have to ask you this. How long had Roxy lived in this town?
She had been here maybe about a year.
Okay.
She had been all over the country, and she was married at the time. Her husband bought. That's another part of the story. I mean, her trailer in, she lived in Florida. Her trailer, where her husband lived, mysteriously blew up one day. And I think it was an attempt on her husband's life, but I can't be sure of it. At any rate, they moved. They took the money, the proceeds that they got from the insurance. They bought this property in Kentucky. And ultimately, she had lived there maybe a year with him. And there's a lot of incidences that they were fighting all the time, and he just did his best to get away, and she was looking for an escape, and she found it by getting him charged with domestic violence and getting him thrown away. But the thing is that there's a possibility that somebody from the locale would know the judge or the prosecuting attorney or something like that, and they're a good old local boy, and they would have been given a little more latitude or a lot more slack than some Yankee that had just come down there to buy drugs and, they weren't from the area, and they didn't like any outsiders or anything like that, and boy, they were bound and determined they were going to get this person.
Right, yeah.
So I think if it was a local person or a southern person in general, they would have been given a little bit more latitude. For an example, if this incident would have happened in Louisville or Bowling Green or something like that, there's no way that I would have been charged with this. I would have been given an appearance ticket and charged $100 and, don't do it again. But in this small little town where it's run by good old boys, it's a good old boy club, we can get this guy here and make ourselves look good.
Wow. Do you describe the town in detail and some of the people in the town in the book?
I do. It's a small little community in south central Kentucky. People don't lock their doors. There's no gang violence or anything like that. It's, pretty laid back. And like I say, everybody knows everybody else's business.
Wow. Does Mark, did you have any allies in Kentucky? You know what? I have to ask you, how long, and I might have asked you this before and forgot, how long were you in Kentucky? You came down, you stayed for 2 weeks, you went back. So after the 2 weeks, you went back to New York. How long were you in New York before you moved down to Kentucky for good? And then how long were you living in Kentucky when this whole incident broke out?
Well, we went up to New York. She got with her family. She got to see her daughter's graduation. In the meantime, I bought a new car, and we packed up all the stuff that was in the storage component, like a storage bin where I had my stuff stored, and she had stuff stored in her storage bin. Packed that all up, put it in a U-Haul, and we came back. That was about 2 weeks up in upstate New York. And it was up until that point, it was heavenly bliss. I was in heaven.
Wow.
It was almost as if, as soon as we hit the Kentucky state line, she reached over and threw a switch that went from angel to devil, because nothing was right after that.
Wow.
And 6 weeks later, I was in jail. So
oh, my goodness.
6 weeks.
Jeez. Did you have any allies, anybody pulling for you in Kentucky? And if so, can you just tell us briefly about those people?
No, I had nobody. I didn't know a soul. I had briefly met two of the neighbors that lived on her road. And you got to understand, the residence that she had was a 23-acre farm outside of town, out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, 5 miles from the main highway.
Jeez.
And the closest neighbor was a mile away. So I had met that one person that lived a mile away, and I'd met the person that lived a mile the other direction once. And,
oh, my
and
God.
That was it. Didn't know anybody in town. They had no resources or anything like that. Yeah, there's a lot of other elements that I didn't go into detail, you know, on this interview, but they're detailed in the book. I mean,
right.
I had opened up a bank account. I wanted a local bank account, and she basically said, "Oh, I'll take care of it, not a problem," and went and got the forms and everything, and it turned out that it was a joint bank account.
Oh.
And I told her, I said,
"Yeah, and I know how that went."
Yeah, well,
she
as soon as I got incarcerated, guess what happened to all the money?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my goodness. Is Roxy back in town as Stains on the Gavel starts to unfold? Is she back in town?
Well, Stains on the Gavel is basically, it gives a background story, a summarization of the background, and then starts out my day in court, and it goes through the whole conviction process. I was convicted, and I was sentenced to 5 years in penitentiary for felony. And I went, and I was transferred from jail to jail to jail to jail to jail 13 times in total. Every time I would complain about my medical conditions, I would be transferred. And it was only through dumb luck that I met a person, another inmate in jail that was very savvy in the legal maneuverings, and he helped me a great deal in being able to write my own legal briefs. And I was successful in those legal briefs and ended up, eventually getting out. And when the whole case was over with, I was still living in Kentucky, and I came back up to upstate New York and found out that Roxy had married my ex-roommate. So,
oh,
to answer your question, yes, she still lives in Syracuse, New York. She's married to my ex-roommate, and I know that she had plans for something bad to happen to him, and I put the kibosh on that. I put a stopper on that. I sent the local police and the state police complete dossier on her 21 different aliases and all the stuff that I'd found in my research and all that. And so she's kind of a lame duck now. She's very, very miserable, as her husband is. And there's details in there why they are still together. She can't do anything as far as getting rid of him, and he can't do anything as far as getting rid of her. So.
Oh, my God. This should be a movie. Oh, my God.
Well,
my
that's
God.
Why, I mean, that's why I promote.
Oh, this is tragic. And you know
gavel.
What? It's also scary. This is scary to me.
I promote on the Gavel because that is the full story. And
oh,
I promote
God.
End as a prequel as what happened before. Because, quite frankly, Pinned has a lot of graphic sex in it. And the reason for that was it was the first novel that I had written, and I was writing from my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I was very hurt at the time, and I was trying to detail as much as I could about how the relationship unfolded and all that stuff. And if I had to do it over again, I would dial that down a little bit because I did get some negative comments about the graphic sex in it. Stains on the Gavel isn't nearly as graphical, and it tells the whole story. So if people want to know the story, read Stains on the Gavel. If they want to know the background in depth, then pick up the prequel, which is Pinned.
Wow. Now, one reviewer said this about Stains on the Gavel. It said it's a dark, gritty, down-and-dirty crime has been committed, and justice has been railroaded in the name of revenge and a good old boy network of trusted public law enforcement authorities. Unfortunately, a man in his 60s is a victim of this injustice, dealing with prison time for crimes he did not commit and is stonewalled at every attempt to prove his innocence or even get a fair day in court. Stains on the Gavel by Charles Macy had my skin crawling in frustration at times, not because this isn't a great read, but because it is so powerfully written. Other than just telling your story, were there any other inspirations for why you decided? Some people would rather hide it and they wouldn't want anybody to know. But it was other than telling your story, was there anything else that inspired you to write Stains on the Gavel?
Essentially, as you brought up earlier, a kind of a warning to because I know this goes on in the social environment. You know, people go into the different dating services, and they should be made aware of the fact that it's not something that is strictly happens to women. You know, You read all these horror stories about ladies getting involved with men that are ex-murderers and haven't disclosed that little fact and all that stuff, but you very rarely read a story where the man is the victim. And that's what makes my book, my story, stand apart. It's not related to gender. It happens to men too.
I got to ask you next. I mean, this story, it sounds very, very gripping and interesting. It's amazing that this lady is still out there. But look, this stuff happens. We see Charles. I forget the one where the woman, they thought she had murdered her child and she walked. This stuff happens. You look at all the evidence and some people, you can't believe it. You're like, I can't believe they're still out there, but they are. Are you working on any new material? I know you've also wrote a children's book, A Boy in the Bin. Are you working on any new material, any novels? And if so, could you give our off-the-shelf listeners a glimpse into what you're working on and when, you know, it might be out on the market?
Well, I just published a book of jokes that's out on the circuit now, 52 Weeks of Jokes, and I'm working on Boy in the Bin. Boy in the Bin is essentially a young adult adventure novel, and my deadline on that is to have that out by August or September of this year. So I'm still working on that. I'm still writing that. But the central character of Boy in the Bin is an adolescent boy. He's like 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a read that would be targeted for adolescents or adults. It's a mystery.
Okay.
So that's what I'm writing now. I think the question you were asking is if there would be any more story related to Pinned and Stained in the Gavel as far as what happened to Roxy and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say a definitive no. She's living in hell with her new husband. And I'm free as a bird, traveling all over the country, having a great time. I'm going on a cruise next month down to Honduras and Cozumel. I'm living a good life right now, no less thanks to her, because she afforded me a vehicle to be able to do that. And the only way that there would be any further dialogue as far as her life or her husband's life or anything like that would be if she were to get arrested. Then I would pick up the reins on that and I would go with that story. But I don't see any more publications coming out in relation to her, because the story's been told.
Right.
And like you say, it's material for a movie. It'd be great on Lifetime Channel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see any more to the story. The story's been told. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And your interest to book publishing came through a very unfortunate experience. Oh, my God, very unfortunate real-life experience. My goodness, my goodness. And I'm researching this whole interview thinking that this was a novel the whole time I'm preparing for the interview. Now I have to ask, and I ask all my guests this, or most of them, writing and publishing a book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that's like the first step. Then you have to actually sell the book. Can you share, and then last few minutes, we only have a few minutes left, about three or four marketing steps have you found to work for you that some of our other off-the-shelf listeners might be able to take advantage of?
Well, I just, I did a lot of self-promotion. I've been going out. I've been doing book signings and shows and getting my name and face out there as much as possible. But I was limited in my contact list and all that, and I ended up just hiring a publicist here within the last 30 days.
Okay.
The publicist, basically what they do is they write articles about me and about the book, and they put them in major publications. And it's not limited to a writer's publication. You know, there might be an article about me in Ladies Home Journal or Red Book or U.S. News and World Report or, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's whoever is interested in that particular article that they write.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a five-month program, and so they're on top of it all. Any requests from reviewers come into them, and they provide them with a review copy of the book, and they handle it all. It takes a lot of weight off me. And
mm-hmm.
they're expensive. A PR company is very expensive, but it's money well spent because they have the contact list that I didn't have. They know where to put the articles and how to make the biggest impact. And so if I were going to make a recommendation to any other authors that are trying to market their book, and there's a lot of different ways. I mean, there's social media. As I did, a lot of shows and stuff like that. But bang for the buck, I think the publicist, having a publicist in your corner, taking the weight off you is a viable way of going about doing it, because what it does is it frees me up and allows me to concentrate on my core, which is writing.
Right.
I don't have to do a lot of the marketing.
Mm-hmm.
John Grisham once said, hey, it's easy to write a book. The problem is selling a book.
Yes, yep.
So that's essentially where it's at. And, anybody that thinks that they can write a book, put it out on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and just wait for the checks to roll in, they're sadly wrong.
True. Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. Before we go, can you tell our off-the-shelf listeners where they can get copies of Pinned and Stains on the Gavel?
Both books are available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other bookstores. It's amazingly, I do a big business in Australia, and I don't know why. I don't do as much anywhere near Europe. But domestically, Amazon and Barnes & Noble are the two places to get the book. They can also get it directly from the publisher, which is Outskirts Press. And there's a link on my website, starshowpublications.com, that will link right to it. In fact, anybody that's interested in reading, they can go to my website and poke around a little bit, and they can download four or five chapters of Stains on the Gavel for free. It's
wow,
a PDF
okay.
file. Just download it for free. And then if they're interested, the links are there for them to buy it through Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whoever is selling it.
Okay. We want to thank you, Charles. We've been delighted to have Charles Macy here with us on Off the Shelf today. We've come down to a close of today's So he's working on A Boy in the Bin, which is a young adult novel, but adults can also read and enjoy it. He's also the author of Pinned, a Kentucky True Crime. It's about a real-life experience. Anybody in online dating or dating period, anybody in a relationship may want to read Pinned, a Kentucky True Crime, and Stains on the Gavel. So, again, Pinned, a Kentucky True Crime and Stains on the Gavel, and he's working on A Boy in the Bin. You can find Charles online at starshowpublications.com. And, again, his books are available online and offline. So please go out and support him. We want to thank Charles again for taking time out of his busy schedule to be here with us on Off the Shelf this Saturday morning. Please, as I always tell you and encourage you, tell your family, your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues, everybody you know who loves books, who loves entertainment, to tune in to Off the Shelf, 11 o'clock on Saturday mornings, New York City time, 11 a.m. Saturday. Every Saturday we bring you fabulous, fabulous guests, and we've had such a broad range of guests on our show, and we have a guest who's coming up. He is an international, I mean a worldwide best-selling author, sold over 120 million copies of his books, and his books have been adapted for television and film. So please, please continue to tune in to Off the Shelf Saturday mornings at 11 o'clock. And as I always tell you, you are so amazing. You are fabulous. You are awesome. Go out and create a wonderful day for yourself, listeners. See you back here next Saturday, 11 o'clock. Thank you so much, Charles. I'll shoot you an email. Bye for now.
Thank you.